From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nothing lasts forever, even globalization as we've known it, says my guest today. The world gets a little bumpy, a little wiser, and the next thing you know, the economy's more local again. That may be happening right now, with implications for our health and wealth and jobs. This hour On Point, when the global economy goes local, you can join the conversation. Are you seeing it? Manufacturing coming home? Local stepping up? Does it sound like wishful thinking? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Later in this hour, we'll hear from an economist who says, talk all you want, global is still global. But first, from New York, Rana Faruhar joins me, assistant managing editor, columnist, and writer at Time Magazine. Her big feature in this week's Time is headlined, The Economy's New Rules Go Global. Rana Faruhar, thanks for joining us. Welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, our listeners are not going crazy for glocal. Full glottal stop.
Right? Oh, come on. Made up words?
Yeah, made up words. I don't know. This one is not soaring at the moment. I know you guys have great wordsmiths at Time. Nevertheless, here, let's give you one response. Shag writes to us. No, listen. I don't know what the hell glocal means, she writes, but I hope it has something to do with producing what you can locally and erecting some modest protectionist barriers. Globalization is bad news for at least 75% of Americans. That's precision. So I welcome any sort of pushback against it. What do you mean? What are you describing, Rana?
Well, your listener actually has a pretty good idea of some of what I'm talking about. So even if the word didn't work, I'm glad the meaning got through. So, you know, as you said in the beginning, globalization is changing. And we're at the middle of a really seismic, or I should say at the beginning of a really seismic shift and change in the way globalization works. So to kind of summarize it quickly, globalization used to be a one-way street that led away from America. The idea was that jobs were going to go abroad, you know, as the playing field got leveled globally.
It wasn't just an idea, right? They went abroad.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, so from the 80s onward, we saw this kind of flattening, you know, and of course, Tom Friedman famously shorthanded it in his book, The World is Flat. Mm-hmm. So that's been sort of conventional wisdom about how globalization works, that basically it's going to be a win for American multinationals, but a loss for American workers, broadly speaking.
And flat meaning anything can go anywhere. Money, jobs, sort of, you know, frictionless, off they go.
That's exactly right. It means a world in which workers, capital, and goods can just move anywhere at will. And we've seen a lot of that, certainly, as you point out. But since the financial crisis, things have started to change. The world is not flat. And in fact, I'll argue that it was never quite as flat as we thought. And it's getting bumpier. And that's happening both politically and economically. And the two create a kind of a snowball effect that's going to result in some very important changes.
What do you mean it's bumpy? What do you mean it's not flat?
So let's just talk about politically for a minute. Look at what's happening in Europe. I mean, you know, Europe is really on the verge of breaking up. The European Union, as we know it, may cease to exist at some point.
So much for the seamless project.
Exactly, so much. And you know, Europe is important because this is the greatest, in some cases, one of the greatest triumphs of globalization, this coming together of these nations into a sort of this peaceful, prosperous bloc. So that's on the verge of breaking apart. China, political tensions rising there. You know, we saw headlines a few months ago about the murder of a British official by the wife of a standing party member. The Communist Party itself is in tumult, and there's an important power transition happening there later this year. You know, we see every day our own partisan politics, and we can look forward to several more months of that in the run-up to the elections, of course. So politically, things are fragmenting. They're getting more tense, and that has economic consequences.
How so? I mean, how does that keep some ball-bearing manufacturer from rolling right out of the U.S. if they're not already gone?
Well, what happens is when people feel scared, when things seem unsafe, when the world seems to be not a calm and peaceful place, but a sort of a rocky one, people become isolationist, they become insular, in some cases they become protectionist. And you can see that in trade, for example. The World Trade Organization, which tracks all of the trade deals and complaints that are happening around the world, has noted a really alarming rise in protectionism over the last couple of years. It's interesting because right after the financial crisis, we didn't see it. A lot of people fretted, oh my gosh, we're going to go back to the 1930s when we had a financial crisis that was then followed by a trade war, which resulted in the Great Depression.
Smoot-Hawley, up go the walls, down comes growth.
Right. I love to hear the word Smoot-Hawley. And that didn't happen. And we sort of went, we all went, woo, you know, in economic circles. But actually, the last couple years, we're starting to see a change now, and protectionism is coming back into play. And also, the financial crisis has resulted, finally, in the re-regulation of banking. That's starting to happen. We've seen just in the last couple of months a couple of major crises, the big J.P. Morgan trading loss, the LIBOR interest rate scandal coming out of Britain that's infected banks here. And so I think that you're going to start seeing banks finally being split up, becoming more regional, more local, being devoted to very specific tasks instead of being these too big to manage organizations. So those are just a couple of them.
So you're describing a picture in which our understanding and experience of globalization, looking back on it, happened in a very particular time, a kind of very calm time when this idea of frictionless flat world seemed just obvious and logical and was in many ways.
Well, that's absolutely right, and that's a very, very important point. Basically, from 1991 or so onwards until 2008, the world was in a really unusual time of peace and prosperity. You had the fall of the Berlin Wall. You had the coming together of Europe. You had the rise of capitalism globally. You had, as Francis Fukuyama would have said, the end of history. But again, since 2008, things have changed. We're seeing more fragmentation, more polarization, and we're not going to see the kind of economic growth that we saw during that period. Just to give you a sense, between 2003 and 2007, the world as a whole grew faster than it ever has before. That's not going to happen again, probably, I think, in our lifetimes at the rate that it did. So when everything's good, all things seem possible. But when things are a little tougher, people hunker down.
So I'm not sure how to take all this. Are you celebrating that we're sliding into some kind of spooky world here?
Well, I'm not celebrating that at all, but I think that there are pros and cons to this. So just to take the dark side for a moment, we've talked a little bit about the risk of protectionism, trade barriers, and those are very real risks. But here's the other thing. There's some upside to this, because when the world was flat and jobs could just be sent to wherever they were flat out cheapest, which is still Asia mainly, companies did that, and they didn't think that much about it. They didn't think about how to really utilize the resources that they might have at home. But now a variety of things are happening that are making American companies, for example, think, well, you know what, maybe we could do things, make things, provide services just as well and potentially more cheaply when you factor in energy costs and productivity increases in America than we could in Asia. So let's just look at a story that was in the New York Times about a year ago. There was an executive at Apple that said, America's problems are not our problems.
Because we're a global company.
Because we're a global company, mm-hmm. That's right. But, you know, there was an interesting article that was written then in Foreign Policy by a labor economist named Clive Prestovitz, and he pointed out, well, Apple may not think that America's problems are its problems, but it depends on Uncle Sam to protect trade routes in the South China Seas, to go after intellectual property violators in China. So there's this sort of, you know, idea that the world is this seamless place where it's really easy to do business, but we're beginning to see rising conflict in the South China Sea, for example, which is an important trade route, a lot of political risk around the world. Companies are beginning to think, you know, it's not so easy just to do business wherever, and maybe we want to be a little more regional, a little more local.
So how does that translate into to real jobs? I mean, you know, at this point, you know, people have manufacturing abroad. I'm reading here, big companies have 60% of their cash outside the U.S. Financial Times saying they're now less tethered also to the domestic market, to the American market for demand. So what's the sort of boots on the ground jobs proof? Are people actually reshoring? Is there a local blossoming in this not quite so flat world?
Yes, they are reshoring, but let's be clear. This is not America versus the rest of the world. This is localization everywhere. So I'm just going to point to Caterpillar, which is a really great company to look at. It's a big American multinational based in Peoria, Illinois.
Yep.
And they make heavy equipment. They make tractors and earthmovers.
Famously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, things like that. So they don't think of the world as one global market, even though they're about the most global company you can think of. They think of it in regions and then in national markets. And the reason is they want to source everything as locally as they can. So they've announced tens of thousands of new jobs in the States over the last couple of years because there's growing demand, for example, in the U.S. gas, natural gas and oil business. And that means that they want to produce close to those customers. That said, they also want to produce close to customers in India. But that means that in both of those places, they're trying to source as much in terms of parts and supplies and labor locally, close to where the customers are. So what's going to happen is, you know, as growth happens in various different regions, I think there's going to be more of a clustering effect where companies are going to want to be where that growth is. It helps them cut their energy costs. It helps them hedge their currency risk. And it helps them tailor products to market and deliver them faster.
How does that dynamic work out for the United States? If everybody's got their little local Caterpillar, is that good for the U.S.? Is that bad?
I think it's very good because there's an interesting study, actually, that McKinsey did that found that most of the growth differential between the U.S. and Europe is down to cities. America has more vibrant cities and sort of regional clusters of growth. I mean, you know, Boston is a great example of this. Raleigh-Durham is another great example. Silicon Valley, of course.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about maybe the next global economy and the importance of local economics rising within globalization. Rana Faruhar is with us, writer, editor, columnist at Time Magazine. Her big piece this week is The Economy's New Rules, Go Global. And Rana joins us from New York. Rana, interesting feedback from listeners all over the place. Judy says, you know, as much as possible, I shop solely in my Chicago neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Not only do I help a local business, I build relationships with owner employees. That's priceless, she says. And you can feel people responding to that, kind of wanting some sort of connection to their world, even their consumption. Well, Christine says, I just purchased a mattress made right in my little town. It's the most comfortable mattress I've ever owned.
That's great. That's a great story.
Yeah. But then, you know, here's sort of the whole... here's a listener says, as more Americans have less wealth, wages continue to stagnate, benefits evaporate, fuel prices rise, disparities make it profitable to make and ship products from the other side of the planet. That's disappearing. Is this coming back because we're just not doing as well?
No, I really don't think so. But, you know, I want to answer that question and also answer the point you raised earlier. I think when I mentioned some strong local ecosystems, I mentioned kind of liberal, wealthy ones because those came first to mind. But you know what? This is also happening in Peoria, Illinois, where Caterpillar is. That company fuels a chain of over 2,000 local suppliers. And these are small and mid-sized manufacturing businesses.
And clustered around Caterpillar, supplying Caterpillar.
Illinois, all of Illinois, and even more so in the general Midwest region. So these are companies that truly would have gone to certainly Mexico, maybe China, in the past. And I met a man, an interesting guy named Bob Parsons, who was a former Kentucky sharecropper, worked on the factory line in the Midwest and then started his own manufacturing business. He does a lot of business supplying Caterpillar now. And one of the things that he does is test new products for them if they want to do a small run of something and then see if they want to actually put it on their own line and spend the money to do millions of runs. Well, Caterpillar used to send that work to China, but they found that between shipping times, communication difficulties, quality being poor, that wasn't working well for him. So he picked up for them that, and he picked up that business. And this is something that he's now capitalized on locally. And I think that in the Midwest, many parts of the Midwest, unemployment is lower than you might think. And while there is still wage compression, I certainly don't want to play that down, and actually Caterpillar itself is in a number of union squabbles, there is
opportunity. Duly noted. I mean, that's not a small thing.
Yeah, and we can come back to that. But there is opportunity, and not just in rich liberal cities because of this trend.
Listener Dan says, I wonder how much of this is a result of increasing fuel prices for international shipping and increases in cost of production in major cheap labor nations like China and India. I mean, is this just fuel driven? It's hard to bring it home. Caterpillar, their products weigh literally tons.
That's right.
Is this really happening? Apple is still making, iPhones over there.
They are, but they're also making them there in part because the Asians are buying more of them. And that goes to this trend of, you know, local hubs will spring up where there is demand. And there's still a lot of demand in the U.S. I mean, yes, the world has flattened to a certain extent, but the U.S. is still a huge consumer market. It's the number one factory company, country in the world by output. But to answer your question about fuel versus labor costs, fuel is certainly an important part of it, but labor costs are equally important. The Boston Consulting Group actually did an interesting study a couple of years ago looking at the wage arbitrage between China and the U.S., and they found that the foreign wages are really going up quite sharply, and the Chinese to U.S. wage ratio was about 3% in 2000. It's about 17% within, you know, in the next 2 years, it'll be about 17%. And I think it's going to reach 75% by about 2030.
And that's because of a rise in China, not a fall in the U.S., or is it both?
That's right. That's because of growing prosperity. And you know what? The Chinese buy a lot of American products. So that's another thing. These are customers, not just competitors.
Yeah, but even the president's been complaining recently about, what is it, there's 75% tariffs on SUVs made in Detroit. And
well, and that's, you know, that plays to this, you know, the fifth rule in my story, actually, that we have to watch out for protectionism, that we have to fuel local
economies. Whose? Ours or theirs or everybody's?
Both. I mean, you know, it's all part and parcel. You know, so one country puts up tariffs, the other responds. So it's very much a snowballing effect when it comes to trade.
Interesting. I want to get some pushback here, but we've got a lot of listeners for you. And this is really interesting, kind of getting nuanced about what globalization means after the great calm of those decades in which it exploded. Maybe it's a little trickier. Maybe it's a little more local. Rana Pruhar, standby in New York. Drew is calling from Waitsfield, Vermont. Drew, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I was just, I mean, it's a great show, and I think it's super interesting to talk about these massive companies like Caterpillar and companies that are that size that are taking things offshore. But I personally work in the outdoor recreation industry, and companies that are, you know, smaller than $100 million a year, or even smaller than $50 million a year. And in that segment, there are numerous companies that have always been here and are just starting to get more attention now as, you know, people like you guys are talking about people coming home, and they're already here.
What are they making, Drew? Kayaks, snowshoes, I don't know what.
Well, there's companies like Kokatat that are making dry suits for kayaking. Sims Fishing Products makes fly fishing gear and waders in Bozeman. Westcomb makes ski jackets. And I think the commonality there is that they're complicated products. I mean, they're not a simple widget that they're banging out of a factory. These are things where the companies like being there and they like having oversight. And I think specifically the paddle sports sector is one where you could literally walk into not a very special canoe store, but any canoe or kayak store and outfit yourself practically head to toe with made in the USA stuff.
Drew, I'm glad to hear that, and I appreciate it. Let me take it to Rana. Mm. I mean, Drew says these are complicated products. Granted, there's a lot of nuance, a lot of subtlety, and you've got here in the outdoor recreation people who want it just the way they want it. On the other hand, you know, we're always hearing about China and other nations abroad wanting to climb the value chain. They, too, want to make complicated, nuanced products.
No, they absolutely do. I will say I've spent a lot of time in China. I think that process of moving up the ladder is going to take a lot longer and be a lot more complicated than it's often portrayed as being in the media. So that's point number one. But point number two is there's another trend that is bringing things more local, and that's customization. So in everything from giant Caterpillar tractors to jeans, let's say, people want products that are made more and more to spec, you know, just for them. They want to be able to even look online and design their own products. And this is a big, big trend in manufacturing. You know, in the next few years, if we believe the techies, you might even have sort of printer-like boxes in your homes where you can program your computer to make you certain kinds of products that will just print out in your house. I mean, this is the level at which customization is happening. But the bottom line is we want things quicker, we want things more tailored, and that means that you have to do them closer to the customer.
I mean, so you say, but with respect, Rana, Walmart's punching out an awful lot of mass-produced, not tailored product. I mean, an awful lot. That's where the scale still is.
Absolutely, and I don't want to say that traditional globalization is not still happening, and Walmart would really be the best example of something like that. But that's a certain kind of retailer, that's a certain kind of customer. They tend to have they winnow down their selection actually every year in order to cut margins. You know, you've won't find 100 different kinds, not whole foods. You know, you're not going to find 100 different kinds of rice. You're going to find three. But that's not the only kind of retailing and manufacturing out there.
Let me get Debbie in Cutchogue, Long Island, New York. Debbie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
I'm calling about a less complicated product.
Right.
I manage a dairy farm out on the North Fork of Long Island, and I'm noticing an influx of people searching out and buying local cheese, local yogurt, that sort of thing, dairy products, and a lot of the local farm stands are finding their business increasing, and the local people trying to make do during the off season, trying to find supermarkets that are buying only from local farms or trying to do so. It's really been a surge. The local, we call them locavores, really try and sustain local farm life and, you know, to try and keep these farms going out here. So pretty much the bottom of the food chain of us.
Hey, I don't know. We think it's the top. I mean, that's what you're drinking on every morning, maybe. I'm glad you raised that. I mean, here's this. This is something, it's part of economics, it sometimes feels beyond it, Rana, but it's desire, people's desire to have something that's produced food, especially close to
absolutely.
Home.
Absolutely. It's such a great point. And I think two callers already have kind of mentioned this idea of local eating, local sourcing of food. And this is, you know, this trend was, I would say, one of the first of part of this global movement. And it has to do with your mood, particularly when things are feeling a little complicated, shaky, scary in the world, we want to hunker down. We want to feel connected. We want to go to our local farmers market. That feels good. That's a desire. That's a mood question, as you say.
But sometimes that may be when we're feeling sentimental or romantic.
Well, that goes hand in hand. I mean, you know, when times are difficult, we are sentimental. We do want things to be simpler.
True, yet we want to keep our eyes on those big numbers and the way the big flows are going because we've got a lot of people to employ in this country.
Absolutely.
Rana, stand by there in New York. Rana Faruhar, writing in Time magazine. She gives us glocal. Do with that what you will. Zachary Carabel joins us now, also from New York. Economist, senior advisor, and president at River Twice Capital Advisors, co-author of Sustainable Excellence and Superfusion. Zachary Carabel, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here as well.
Hi, Tom.
What do you make of this notion that, you know, globalization was fast and furious and almost frictionless for a while, but it's not anymore? And things are coming home. Things are going glocal. Local is big again, and that's changing the shape of the economy. What do you say, Zach?
Well, first of all, just a philosophical comment. You know, we want to capture reality and understand it, and we tend to want to do so these days in real time. Mm-hmm. So there is a tendency to try to figure out what's going on in the world, make generalizations, and say this is the trend. And so
hey, that's the Weekly Magazine business. It's my business too. It's probably your business. I mean, what choice do we have in this world? It's moving fast. We're trying to stay on top of it.
So my point around that is we will have a better sense of whether or not the world is flat, not flat, local, glocal, or global 20 years from now when we look back at this than we do now. And there were a lot of people 5 years ago, and Rana is entirely right, that who were saying, even when this was the rage to talk about globalization, were saying, hey, wait a minute. A lot of people don't travel. Most phone calls are domestic. Most business is conducted within a 50-mile radius of where you live and do business. That was true 10 years ago, and it's true now. On the flip side, I would say that, I mean, my view is that there is more globalization. There is more de facto globalized markets with few barriers than there ever has been, and that while the acceleration of those trends has ceased, the reality of that has not.
Even in this bumpier time where the world's not quite so flat, where there's speed bumps of political and fuel price and every other nature around.
Right. So again, I would describe this as I think that the pace at which that is happening, that national boundaries are being eroded, that sovereignty of governments and their ability to kind of govern their own economic national system, the pace of that erosion has slowed precipitously so that we are no longer accelerating. And in some sense, as Rana just points out, that is in sync with the slowdown of the global economy in general, meaning as things were heating up and there was more activity, there was more breakdown of these barriers, and that kind of became a virtuous circle. Now that stopped. But there's a difference between that ceasing to expand and that beginning to manifestly contract. And I would debate that we are not, that that's not contracting nearly as much as it simply is ceasing to grow right now.
Rana, what do you say to that? We've already, you know, we were pinning the needle for years on globalization, the sort of flat world. It's out there, and it hasn't turned around enough, maybe, to really change that profile.
Well, let me just say I completely agree with Zachary that you need to look in 20-year chunks to really get a clear picture. But what I was, what I would say is,
you're fired.
I'm out of here. you know, what I would say is that when you look at the underlying trend data, the slowing of global growth, the slowing of markets. I mean, interesting comment. Bill Gross, who runs a company called PIMCO, which is the world's largest bond trader, was quoted the other day in the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journal, I can't remember which, as saying that he thought that the stock market was a Ponzi scheme, that we were never going to see 6% returns again. We'd be lucky to see 3. I mean, when Bill Gross is saying that, there's some big shifts in the market. So that's number one. So I think these underlying trends that support the themes I'm talking about are lasting and real, and big brains are thinking a lot about this. There is another part of this that we haven't really talked about yet, and that is the shrinking middle. So in all rich countries, there's a middle class problem. You know, we have labor bifurcation, we have the wealthy taking a greater share of the pie than ever before, and that's a problem that's not going away in the U.S., in Europe, in wealthy parts of Asia. And I think that politically, that supports localization because it's going to force governments to do something about these jobs in the middle and about creating some prosperity.
Well, just sit on that one for a minute because why has the middle class had such trouble in the countries that have done well? And why would a reversal of globalization or at least a localization within it really be good for them? I mean, Bill Gross is not exactly celebrating when he says, you know, growth is coming down from 6 to 3.
No.
You know, maybe we're celebrating some kind of, it's local because they're just groaning to a halt and, you know, people are clipping the grass in their backyard, but that doesn't make you a ton of money.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that it's not it's not about cheering or sobbing. You know, there's ups and downs to all this. I'll take the first part of the question first. Why have labor markets bifurcated? Well, traditional globalization, the rise of technology, which crushed a lot of middle-income manufacturing and blue-collar jobs, or changed them, which is something I get into in this story, and outsourcing. But what's happening now, and this is very interesting, is that blue-collar jobs in this country are going high-tech. So you can see this at Caterpillar, for example. They do a lot of welding. And they hire, they buy robots to do a lot of the very tedious, low-end, physically demanding welding work. But interestingly, that hasn't cut the number of human welders they employ. It's just meant that their skill level has to go up because they now have to program computers and work with high-tech machinery that they didn't in the past. So rather than having that be a job that you can do straight out of high school, that's now a job that you need a community college degree or at least some serious in-house training to deal with. And that's something where the government, working with private partners, can step in on already. I mean, the Obama administration would like to spend, I think it's $8 billion on community college systems. That budget is in gridlock. But at the local level, again, you're seeing mayors start to act around this stuff. Mayor Bloomberg, Rahm Emanuel in Chicago, they're all setting up these community college programs, working with employers like Caterpillar, like IBM, to try and retrain this workforce and create some real decent jobs.
We'll look at that. Zach, just 10 seconds before the break. So we're competing with China and robots. Can we really win 8 million jobs back in that environment?
Yeah, I mean, I think more to the point, we've been for years in an age of capital. So anyone who's in a global multinational, whether it's Caterpillar or business, has done incredibly well over the past 20 years. And anyone who is labor has done rather poorly.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the next global economy this hour, the importance of local rising within globalization, says my guest Rana Faruhar, assistant managing editor at Time Magazine. Her big piece in the magazine this week is The Economy's New Rules Go Global. Zachary Carabel joins us as well. He's with River Twice Capital Advisors, author of Sustainable Excellence and Superfusion. Rana, Zachary, let me go to Lee in Hollywood, South Carolina. Lee, you're on the air.
Hi, Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm walking around my yard right now and in my house, and I'm looking at all this made in China stuff, which, of course, is either broke or breaking. I have a kite here that I just bought, made in China, flew it for the first time, it ripped. Now, why can't I could go on with my list.
Mm.
Why are we not at least making kites here? A kite that you fly. How simple is that? These scissors that I have, these garden tools that are rusting, why aren't we making those here?
Well, simple to make a kite, maybe, but how much do you want an hour to make that kite,
right?
I guess, Lee? And, you know, people used to say junk about Japan, and they don't anymore, but on the other hand, it sounds like a business opportunity, Zach.
Well, I bet you that there's, I'm making this up a little bit, but I bet you there's someone in Brattleboro, Vermont, making incredibly beautiful, handcrafted $60 kites.
Well, yeah, for somebody who tootles up in their Audi on the weekend, but that may not be Lee.
But we don't want, I mean, I think that most economists would argue that kites, like shoes or light fixtures, are jobs that we actually... We don't mind that so much. We don't need to keep those here. But very high-end equipment, technological products, high-end machinery, like again, what Caterpillar does, I think those are the kind of jobs we want to keep.
And even if we did keep them here, right, if we had an American kite and scissor manufacturing renaissance, as you point out before, that would likely be done by robotics and machines. So even though our manufacturing output might increase, Tom, our employment would increase only minimally. So even there... You can make the argument we should be able to make those better. They should be of somewhat higher quality. Maybe you'd spend an extra dollar or two or three in order to have that extra quality. But it wouldn't necessarily be a job creator, because even as you go local, that doesn't mean you create local jobs.
That's right. And I would add to that, the kind of companies that really create a lot of jobs tend to be those that are doing technological innovation. So great example of this that kind of blends tech and manufacturing would be Pratt & Whitney. They've worked for many years, I think about a decade, on a very green jet engine, which has created a tremendous number of jobs in the area of the country that they're in. And it's going to have a ripple effect, because now they're selling the thing all over the world. Tweaks are being made to it, second-generation products. It just goes on. And that's, again, fueled this entire chain of local suppliers in that area.
I mean, that's great, and it sounds great, but, you know, there's an awful lot of people waiting for that ripple to not only bring jobs to where they are, but to bring better wages.
Well, you know what would, if I can just add one point, you know what would help a lot is if we had a functional government, because we can look at Germany, and this is a great example of how you can make localization really pay off if you have some government support. I mean, the Germans have for a long time worked together very well in terms of the public and private sector coming together. When the Great Recession happened, they kind of did a huddle between government, companies, and labor and figured out what they needed to do to actually keep people in jobs, even if they had to go part-time, even if the government had to pay temporarily to keep factories.
But like doing what? I mean, around here, that tends to mean just a tax breaks for new factories coming. That seems to be about the extent of that kind of huddle.
That's the point. I mean, we're looking too short-term. It's difficult to talk about these things, because then you look and say, well, you know, what's going to change in Washington? Well, nothing before the election, certainly. But really, we have to make some big decisions in this country.
But like what? What does Germany do that we don't do in that huddle? What do they talk about?
They have, for example, labor representatives sit on the boards of most major German companies. They police salary packages. They make sure that the pie is more equally shared. They ensure that workers are given training on an ongoing basis so their skill level remains high. That's why Germans can charge a lot more for their products, and they are still bought all over the world. They take care of their infrastructure. They invest in their own competitiveness, and that's a key thing. If countries anywhere are going to capitalize on the global trend, they're going to need to remain competitive, and that requires investment.
Zachary, where does that push come from? I mean, Mitt Romney is, you know, says successful in business. On the other hand, it seems to kind of conflict a little with what Ron is saying, because Mitt Romney says get government out.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly the right analysis of how Germany has maintained a level of competitiveness, although, you know, we'll see how well Germany does in the next 2 years as the Eurozone continues to deteriorate.
Yeah.
So, you know, to the degree that Germany has benefited from a lot of trends within the Eurozone, we may be saying a somewhat different story about Germany, although the analysis is certainly right. I guess my take is that in the United States, those elements that Ron has just talked about as being applicable in Germany seem so far from any feasible outcome given American attitudes, which is, you know, people want
You mean on planning, on education, on cooperation?
And also, they don't want to pay more for products. They don't want to limit the potential for earnings. I mean, there's a lot of trade-offs in the German model that Americans seem, from what we can tell, largely unwilling to make.
German companies accept lower profit margins? Are you saying that?
German companies do accept lower profit margins and lower pay scales, and German investors in their markets, when they're not external investors, are not demanding quite the same metrics that American investors.
You mean pay scales for executives or line labor or both?
It's both. I mean, a German executive pay is much less than American executive pay, as is Japanese, as we know.
But if you look at German per capita income, it's not like it's a whole lot lower than U.S.
No, German per capita income is slightly higher, I think, in purchasing power than the United States. But German cost of living is also higher than it is in the United States because of the very reasons that Rana talked about. So I think what that's left with is, you know, in the United States, you have a lot of virtues of local. People clearly will pay more for local, right? The locavore market. They'll pay more at their local farmers market. They'll pay $10 for a quart and a half of artisanal lemonade, but they certainly wouldn't pay the same amount going into Walmart.
If I can jump in, though, and, you know, talking about what we can do here and how impossible all this seems from Washington, that's all true. I mean, we're a long way from being as far-sighted as Germany, certainly in terms of public policy and governance at the federal level. But I want to talk again at the local level.
Okay.
This is already happening. I'm going to tell you about a program. There's a school in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, fairly close to where I live, called PTEC. And this is a public-private partnership between IBM, the New York City School System and Technical College, and a number of other sort of local partners. And the reason that Bloomberg and IBM came together to do this is that they realized that there is a shortage of middle-skilled workers, so people that have kind of a two-year degree that can do middle-level jobs in a company like IBM or another. And they saw this as a growth problem. And so they've come together to create this high school where kids will complete a four-year degree, but then they'll go on and get a two-year degree as well. And what's very interesting is that the curriculum is shaped in part by the employers. The educators and the employers are speaking to each other very closely and making sure that these kids actually graduate with some real skills rather than, you know, a two-year degree in, you know, recreational marketing.
So what does it mean if that's a New York solution, not a federal solution? Will
spreading.
It get marched out around the country, or will it just
it's
be
whoever's
got their act together enough to do it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, but that is the global trend I'm talking about. There's already five of these now in New York. Rahm Emanuel has just signed on to adopt the model in Chicago. It's being talked about in parts of the Southwest. So things are springing up from the local level. And this is another important trend in localnomics, or whatever you want to call it, is that mayors and local political players will become more important on the national stage. This is where ideas are going to bubble up from.
It's interesting. Joe in Auburn, Alabama. Thanks for calling, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a point to this globalization you're talking about. The United States is still probably the largest consumer market in the world, and international companies realize that, and especially the car companies. Here in the state of Alabama, we have at least four international car companies, Mercedes, Toyota, Hyundai, and the latest one is Kia, which is right up the road from Auburn in West Point, Georgia, and they bring in provide thousands of jobs for people here in Alabama and Georgia. I mean, they have a boulevard that's practically a mile long where their plant is.
So talk about local. I mean, they're coming to you, Joe.
That's what I'm saying. Instead of our companies are going overseas, other companies are coming to the United States because it is the greatest consumer market in the world, I think.
Rana, how far does that go? I mean, Joe sees it just down the road from his place there, and it sounds like you're welcome.
Absolutely. I mean, I wrote about the Airbus announcement to move a big factory to Mobile in my piece, and it's certainly happened in Detroit. It's happening in many areas of manufacturing because, as I mentioned in the story, this sort of arbitrage, this calculation of where you put labor is no longer just about where are wages absolutely lowest. It's about skill level. It's about energy cost. It's about shipping. It's about where the consumers are.
Zach, how about it? World a little bumpier. Maybe if we just hang in there, everybody will come to us and set up factories here, and voila, jobs.
Well, again, this is not a new thing. I mean, as people pointed out in 2008, 2009, when the U.S. auto industry was falling apart, one of the oppositions to the auto bailout came from states like Tennessee and Alabama, which said that, look, we've got all these foreign companies, whether it's Toyota or Hyundai, setting up shop here in a non-unionized fashion at much lower pay scales. And so why should we, you know, bail out these old unionized industries?
But it's all a matter of scale and degree, right? I mean, if we got a lot more of it, we'd have a lot more jobs. Do you see that
coming?
Well,
I mean, again, the auto industry, even in the auto industry, it's an example of we have a lot fewer jobs, and we're making a lot more autos because half of those floors are just in time, half of them are roboticized. And of course, the larger point is that all this localization, a lot of it's being done by companies that are inherently global. Rana's point about Caterpillar, they are deciding where it's most efficient for them to produce and distribute their supply chain, but they are still global enterprises in that these are not like mom-and-pop companies that are springing up locally. These are massive multi-billion-dollar multinational institutions localizing their production in 180 different countries, or at least trying to sell into that.
They do support the mom-and-pop shops. I mean, it's interesting because Caterpillar and IBM and AMD, Pratt & Whitney have all come together to create something called the Supply Network, which is it's a pledge that these big multinationals are making to source locally when they can. They've already put hundreds of millions of dollars into sourcing from local businesses, and this has a huge knock-on effect. So the average small business that becomes a supplier to a big company like that sees about 164% employment growth within 2 years.
Well, but look at it in big economic terms. I mean, there was a time when we were the export power, and that built a lot of wealth in this country. Then China grabbed that.
We still are.
But clearly, look at our trade balance, you know, and you see a different story. Now, China grabbed that crown. If everybody gets more local, does that work, Zachary, for the U.S.? Does it support, you know, we famously have, what is it, the percentage of world GDP is here way beyond our percentage of population.
Yeah, I mean, look,
does it, you know, keep us in the manner to which we are accustomed?
It absolutely works. And as much as, you know, we're sort of framing this as a debate between localization and globalization, the two are not inherently incompatible in that you need lots of local activity to support lots of global activity. You know, one of the real challenges of the past years has been the degree to which global enterprises have profited disproportionately to national economies, back to that labor capital, local jobs versus global jobs.
Yep.
And, you know, at some point you need the local vibrancy to support these multinationals, and they get that. I mean, that's why they are making those investments, because if you completely denude your global consumer base and all of your profits just show up in offshore earnings that are, sit in some Cayman Island bank account, you have no business.
Pretty soon the Cayman Islands are not big enough.
I totally agree with that point, and this was made to me by a couple of executives at IBM who realized, I mean, a lot of small businesses are their customers. That's who buys their product and services. So they know, as many American firms do, that they're in trouble if the local economy collapses. Yep. Harvard Business School is actually doing a big sort of campaign around this and trying to get businesses to think more local.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of arbitrage there. There's a lot of opportunity in other countries, too. But still, Mark in Stoneham, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your story?
My story is in 1989, I started a company dedicated to building product in the U.S. and grew it over a 20-year span. And only in the last few years did competition get so rough that we had to produce our product in China.
Okay.
I sold that company. I'm starting another company, and I'm trying to organize the company so that I can maintain domestic production far into the future.
Why are you doing that, Mark?
For a number of reasons. I believe in making stuff locally. I believe that business is personal, and you can be a lot more personal when you can meet face-to-face easily with your suppliers. I personally didn't enjoy my trips to China, and I believe that putting people to work in our local economy is a good deal.
And how's it going so far? Can you be competitive?
Well, the major difference between my former company and my present company is my former company, we sold wholesale to retailers, and the retailers sold to the customers.
Mm-hmm.
In my new company, we sell direct online, circumventing the retailer and the retail margin, and I believe that that is one important way that I can deliver value to the customer and still maintain domestic supply chain.
There it is right there. Come home, America. There's your example, Rana.
Yeah, no, well done. And I think that raises a very important point about going directly to the manufacturers, going directly to the consumer themselves and cutting out the middlemen.
So, I don't know, Zach's not quite sold that it's coming home as strong as you say. You yourself, right, this could go either way. It could get protectionist and kind of dark and shrinky instead of growth-oriented.
Yeah, there's, you know, we're at a turning point, and it'll be interesting to see the results of the election in the U.S. I think that...
Why? What does that matter in this story you're telling?
Because, it certainly matters in terms of where wealth will flow and whether we start to see more or less labor bifurcation.
Why? Again, are you saying that Romney goes a different way than Obama in the terms that you're describing here, or Obama different from Romney?
Well, it's difficult to it's difficult to say what part of a campaign platform is actually going to turn into real policy and governance.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, if the Romney-Ryan, if what they're saying on the campaign trail becomes policy, then yes, I'm very worried about an even bigger hole in the middle of the American economy. But the bigger question is kind of big government versus small government, and does government have a place in helping the economy? Does government have a place in helping labor? I would argue, of course it does. Historically, it always has. You can look at almost every big company in this country has been, in some way or another, helped by the government. I think it's going to become more important in the future. I'm going to use a third rail word here, industrial policy. Everybody else does it. We probably should start thinking about it ourselves.
Zachary, on balance, what do you think? Is it coming home a little bit? Is it going to help out the U.S. economy or still?
Look, I'm sure it will help the U.S. economy. The larger point, though, is regardless of whether you have local factors or global factors, we are certainly in a world where we, whether it's the United States, whether it's China, whether it's Europe, are not going to thrive without multiple other parts of the world thriving. We are global enough, regardless of the trends, that we are all singing or swimming together.
Yep. Zach, we're out of time. Zachary Carabel, Rivertwise Capital, Rana Faruhar, Time Magazine. Thanks to you both. This is On Point.